behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
And we've got another listener suggestion today that I'm kind of excited about talking about this one. This is something that I really had no idea existed. Mm-hmm. I don't know how this has evaded me for so long. I've seen these cars in photos and just not really understood what they were, maybe.
Or followed up on it. Yeah. This I think, surprised both of us, Scott. Mm-hmm. Do you have a copy of the letter?
I do. This comes from one of our listeners who writes in often, Rudy. Rudy Smith.
Oh, yeah. Hey,
and,
Rudy.
Rudy wrote in an email to us and just kind of... Well, actually, it's a follow-up on an email that we read in one of our Nuts and Bolts episodes, the recent one, Part 9. Just to mention about these coal dust-powered cars that he had said something about early on, it's kind of like a World War II era vehicle that's where this all starts, I should say.
Yes.
Just kind of set this up. But Rudy says that he had no idea that coal, sawdust, and wood were such influential fuels in the past, and to some extent, they're still being used today, but not anything like what they were back in this World War II era, a vehicle that we'll talk about. There were some ads that were from the late 30s, early 40s that show some of these cars in particular saying that this is, you know, kind of the way of the future. This is what we're going to be using now for power.
Yes.
I think the one that he mentioned was kind of a tourism or publicity shot that he had seen, you know, an ad, a very flashy ad of, you know, a well-dressed couple overlooking the town of Rio and, mm-hmm. you know, or the city of Rio. Just really kind of an interesting mix of technologies coming together on these cars. So yeah. Rudy's interested in them, wants to know about them. Also, he mentions a coal-powered motorcycle. Right. We'll talk about, I promise. not a whole lot, but just that it kind of follows along the lines of these coal dust-powered cars and coal gas-powered cars.
Yeah, and we'll even talk about maybe some wood-burning cars.
Yeah, wood-burning cars. Yeah, it's just, man, there's so many of these early, I'll call them alternative fuel vehicles.
Yeah, that's a good
maybe
phrase.
It's probably the best way to say it, but let's jump right in with the coal-powered cars. How about that?
Yes. Can we do coal gas, maybe? I have a quick sidebar.
Yeah, sure, yeah. What have
you
got?
This is pretty cool. So we found a story that was published in The Mercury, a newspaper of note, in January of 1918.
Okay, so way back.
Way back. This is a deep cut, my friend. This thing is called The Modern Use of Coal Gas. A most successful demonstration of the use of coal gas for motor purposes was given recently in London through the enterprise of the Commercial Motor and the Motor. And so it talks about how this journal has, this kind of a piece about how coal gas may be the future of transportation, written in 1918. A little bit of background here, maybe an old school voice. The conversion of motor vehicles to enable them to run on either petrol or coal gas has been necessitated by the shortage of the former fuel. Early in the year 1916, it was seen that with growing shortage of petrol and the difficulties attending its importation, an alternative home-produced fuel would have been found, would have to be found.
Is that your newsman read there?
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like that. I thought doing a British accent might be offensive.
It felt a bit like the movies, you know, when they would play the news clips from around the world.
Yeah.
Something like that. Man. Yeah, a little bit like that. So, but, you know what? I understand what you're saying, where you're getting at here, that this may be the future is what they're saying at the time.
Right.
And they really started to move towards using these alternative fuels like coal and wood and any kind of biomass material, really.
Yeah, because of the shortage of traditional petrol,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, there were tremendous shortages going on, which we'll find out later became extreme in some cases. And then there was rationing that was happening as well.
Yeah.
But I guess before we go too much farther, I need to say this. I originally thought, when I heard of these coal-powered cars, I thought initially, just right off the top of my head, I was thinking steam-powered.
Oh, okay. So, like, the coal is burned, producing energy to boil water, creating steam.
Exactly. Just as it would in a locomotive. And
yeah.
And that's the way that I normally think of converting coal power into energy for an automobile. Or for, not for an automobile, but maybe for just any kind of device to move somebody, you know, like a transportation method, I
sure,
guess.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm so accustomed to seeing the steam trains of that era.
Yeah, with the boiler tanks and stuff.
I would think that they would try to miniaturize that for the automobile, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's not what they did. They, in fact, what happened was they were leaving the internal combustion engines in place, and they're using coal or coal dust in some cases, coal gas, I should say, to power the vehicle through a different way. I mean, and how do they get to coal gas? That's kind of the, I guess, the angle we need to take on this.
That's the big tilt.
Here. Yeah, that is. And what coal gas is, for anybody that doesn't know, is it's a mixture of gases, hydrogen, methane, and carbon monoxide. And those are created by the destructive distillation of coal. So you have to have this distillation process that happens, and it creates this this mixture of gas that can be used for, a lot of times it's used for heating and lighting, or it was. I don't know if it is so much anymore. But it's the gas that's given off when coal is burned. And I mean, you can look up information on coal gasification and find out, you know, that can be used to, it can, that same gas, which is sometimes called town gas, by the way, can be converted into transportation fuels like gasoline or even diesel, through additional treatments. And these treatments include this, this process, which is called, the Fischer-Tropsch. And I'm going to mess that up, but it's T-R-O-P-S-C-H, Tropsch.
Okay.
Fischer-Tropsch process. And that's where there's this collection of chemical reactions that converts the mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen into liquid hydrocarbons. Okay, so you're really taking, you know, this gas and it's how it goes from gas to liquid to create this either synthetic lubrication oil or a synthetic fuel, like which will come from coal or natural gas or biomass, like you know, trees or like you know, wood, of course.
Yeah.
And later I want to talk about a wood gas generator, but we're still on coal right now, so let's hang with that.
We'll hang with coal.
And just understand that we're talking about cars that still have their internal combustion engine in place. They're using some method in order to get coal gas into the engine to burn that.
Yeah.
Or they're creating their own, they've got their own distillation process.
It's creating some liquid fuel.
On board, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, which is really kind of remarkable, especially when you think about this is happening almost 100 years ago.
Yeah, and here's what blows my mind about it. It seems so overly complicated from the modern perspective, right?
Yeah.
We already have gasoline technology. We have the ways to create gasoline. We have the engines down to a T, right? So much so that we've spent the next almost of a century or so just improving upon internal combustion without necessarily fundamentally changing it.
Yeah, we're mostly tuning at this point.
Right, but here's the problem. Here's what happens. In World War II, the entirety of Europe has this huge fuel shortage, right? And from that article we quoted earlier, one of the things that's interesting is the way that they end this is they say that liquid fuel is superior to this other stuff in every way except for cost.
Okay.
And this comes up again because oil imports during World War II are blocked. And in Europe, you know, even today, Europe has, it remains an oil importer, right?
So
the oil that was available was all for tank fuels, aviation and stuff.
Yeah, so these are primarily vehicles that came about during times of shortage or crisis, and even some, you know, a modern version that we're going to talk about, or sort of modern version that we're going to talk about, comes from a time of crisis. And I just want to point out that, you know, a lot of these were due to rationing as well.
Yes.
And it's a way to get around something. It was a form of necessity. I mean, it's a way for people to continue to exist. They've got automobiles, they've got tractors, they've got, farm implements that they need to be able to use. It's just a way to mobilize, you know, your machinery that you had on hand. I mean, otherwise you wouldn't be able to get into town to be able to buy food, or you maybe,
sure,
you know, if you're on a farm or whatever, I mean, you're kind of self-sufficient, but maybe you do have to get into town to get certain things, certain goods or
certain manufactured goods.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, there were times of crisis, and especially in, like, you know, Nazi Germany and occupied France at the time.
Oh yeah. Cause, they had a lot of coal, but no oil.
Yeah, and we're talking about, like, you know, times just prior to World War II and during World War II, of course. But afterwards, you know, that's a whole different can of worms. But it does happen in times of crisis and times of need. And people adapt, Ben. They're very good at adapting. So what they had to do is they tried to find a way. You know, they got all this coal, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
They got a lot of wood, of course. You know, trees,
yeah.
trees everywhere, right? How are you going to convert that into a way, how are you going to burn that in your engine in order to make it work? So you
right,
because
you can't build brand new engines. That's the cost is extravagant.
Exactly. So and an alternative way. I mean, like I mentioned, you know, the steam thing that may have been somebody's initial idea. Like maybe we can use steam power in order to get things, you know, going here. And that, of course, there were steam cars, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But to convert a car that's already got an internal combustion engine over to a steam powered engine. I mean, and you're talking about people that are trying to do something with nothing. They really have very little on hand. You know, this is just a way around. It's a workaround, really,
mm-hmm.
I guess. That's probably the best way to say it, is it's a workaround.
Right. And it is, like many workarounds, it is ingenious. I mean, with all the politics of the time aside, one thing that everyone can agree on is this is some MacGyver-level mm-hmm. business right here. I'm glad that you brought up the part about biomass and about wood, because Nazi Germany actually did convert a lot of their vehicles to wood-burning vehicles. So they used the gasification of coal as part of it, but then they also created cars that could run on burning wood. And this was a big business at the time, Scott. Ford, General Motors, other manufacturers made conversion kits, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And this could use the people who own these cars could also make their own homemade kits. But I want to talk about some of the military stuff that the Nazis did at the time. Some German-made wood-burning cars were stuff like the Beetle, which was post-war,
mm-hmm.
The KDF Wagen at that time, the Kubelwagen, and they also had the SS had a series of generators that were wood-burning.
Hmm.
So you burn wood to generate electricity, and these were called Holzbrenners, wood-burners, and guess who made them?
Who made them?
Porsche.
Very interesting.
So it's strange when we think, you know, it's strange to think these things were so widespread and yeah. so popular, but now we don't see them near as much.
Ah, Dr. Porsche, he was always kind of on the edge of stuff like that. I mean, I think, isn't he credited with the first hybrid car, as a matter of fact?
I believe so.
I think he is. So, yeah, he's always kind of interested or he was directed to be interested in a lot of these early experiments with alternative fuels and alternative powers, I guess.
One last sidebar?
Yeah.
I promise I'll get out of World War II.
Later. That's all right.
So, back in 1944, General George Patton, right, and mm-hmm. the Allies are trying to be the first force to reach Berlin,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
Patton's guys. And so his forces were moving so fast that they couldn't keep up the supply lines. You and I have talked before about how important a supply line is, right?
Absolutely.
And so Patton said that let's just drain this synthetic fuel, the wood-burning fuel that's been produced by the Germans in these vehicles, and then he had some of the U.S. tanks converted to run on this fuel.
No kidding.
That's how the story goes, man.
Okay, so it's pirated fuel, I guess, that was operating some of those tanks in the early days.
Pirate fuel,
yeah,
yes. Okay, what do you got?
Well, listen, we just mentioned fuel, wood as fuel. I think I want to go back to that in a bit, because
okay.
There's some interesting stuff that comes about when we talk about wood-burning cars, and there are still wood-burning cars out there. People are still doing this.
Yes.
Doing this with a passion.
Ooh.
So we'll talk about that, I promise. But I do want to mention something else with these, I guess, coal gas-powered cars.
Okay.
If you do a Google search for coal gas-powered car or coal gas car,
yeah.
You're going to find some just absurd-looking photos of these cars that have this enormous canvas bag on top of the car, right?
Yeah, like a balloon.
It looks like a tarp or something
balloon.
That's,
yeah.
Yeah, a balloon, exactly. But, I mean, we're talking about on a platform that's, you know, a metal platform that's welded in place.
And it looks kind of like, the platform itself looks kind of like, what you see on a pontoon boat or on something you dive on.
Almost like the deck of a pontoon boat that's elevated above the car. That's maybe the best way to put it. Or, you know, like when they do a dive platform on top of one of those boats.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. And then on top of that is this enormous bag that can be filled with, you pull over the curb and have somebody pump in this this coal gas,
mm-hmm.
and that's what the car operates on. And we mentioned earlier how they get to coal gas,
make that town gas, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and I'm sure that there's something that has to be done to the engine. I know there's a different carburation method that has to be used mm-hmm. in order to burn that type of fuel, but that's what you operate on. It seems incredibly dangerous to me to be driving around with a bag full of gas on top of the car. Now, it's not liquid. It's
uncompressed.
It's obviously vapor, of course, uncompressed. So it's not anything under pressure. But, man, it just seems like there's a lot of room for problems there.
Yeah. Can you imagine a fender bender? God forbid somebody is smoking.
Yeah.
In the area.
Yeah, that can happen.
And this was also, strangely enough, this was at a time when I imagine quite a few people were smoking still.
I would think so, yeah. Probably even doctors in hospitals.
Probably people in these cars.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's really interesting, you guys, you do check out the pictures here if you have time, because we were bowled over at first when we saw this. The reason that these containers have to be so large, these inflatable bags have to have so much gas, is because it's uncompressed. But there's one advantage that's a little bit silly, which is you can easily tell how much more fuel you have, because as you drive, the bag deflates.
That's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's a visual indicator of how much fuel you have left in the vehicle. Now, there's also another little side note here that that Rudy sent along, and this is about coal-powered motorcycles.
Ah, yeah.
And it's exactly the same as these coal gas cars on a smaller scale. They've got these ridiculous photos online of these coal gas-powered motorcycles from the same time. You know, we're talking turn of the century again. You know, this photo that I'm looking at here is from Nottingham in 1916. And the motorcycle is a Campion, which is a local manufacturer who created this thing. And it's got the same gas bag that's suspended above the riders. And it's in a different way, a different manner, I guess. It's
more above the sidecar.
Yeah, it's more of above the sidecar. Yeah, that's right. I didn't even notice that, with children in it. So the kids are below this giant gas bag. It looks like a tube it looks like almost like a big missile, really, because they've made it kind of aerodynamic in a way. But if you search for coal-powered motorcycle, you're going to see exactly what I'm talking about. Very strange vehicle. I have never seen anything like this at, you know, a concours event, any kind of show or anything like that. But there is a car that kind of makes the rounds at the concours events, that has, one of the coal systems that we talked about, right?
Oh.
It's a Citroen.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. You're talking about the famous coal gas powered Citroen.
Yeah, it's from 1938, and it's called the Traction Avant, mm-hmm. Which means, I think that just means front wheel drive.
Right. It was converted by FAP Elgazo Tarbes. It made some adaptations that were necessary for it to run on coal. So they removed the stock carburetor intake manifold and inserted a mixing system along with a large container under the right front fender, like a big cylinder filled with coal and ignited.
Yeah.
And
this one's different, Ben. I mean, I just want to make sure that people understand it's not a coal bag car.
Right.
You're describing it correctly. I'm just saying it's not one of these coal bag cars.
It doesn't have the gas bag on top.
This one is a completely different animal.
Yeah, and it's much, much more aerodynamic looking. It's a good looking car. However, this coal system does reduce horsepower by about 20%.
Whoa.
Yeah, so the top speed goes down to 55 miles per hour. And we're going to talk maybe a little bit about the range. Do you want to talk about range
now? Let's talk about range on this one, because the range on this car was very low, wasn't it?
Yeah, only about 40 miles before you had to add more coal.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, you'd think that – I don't know why I had it in my head that these would have a longer range than a normal gasoline-powered vehicle or a diesel-powered vehicle.
Yeah, and that makes sense, because that's what we think about. We're kind of taught to think that way, that lower performance in terms of red line speed or whatever mm-hmm. means that there will be more durability or stamina for the
vehicle. Yeah, sure. More stamina, I guess. A greater miles per gallon, I guess, in the case, or equivalent of miles per gallon. I don't know what that would be with coal.
Not the case here.
Per nugget. I don't know how you would determine that. But, and I also want to say that, this 1938 Citroen Traction Avant that we're talking about, I mean, it's a very integrated design, like you mentioned, but mm-hmm. not all of them had this coal power capacity.
Very good point.
Actually, only 2,000 of these cars that were produced were converted.
And only a few of those survived.
Yeah, so there's very, very few of them out there. Now, I think that, man, it looks like the production, if it went from where I'm looking at here, I think the production of this type of vehicle was from 34 to
57?
1957. Something like 760,000 cars were produced of this type of model. And again, only 2,000 of those were converted. So, these are a needle in a haystack, really. I mean,
yeah.
that's why, you know, a well-preserved version of this can, you know, can tour on something like the Concours events.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you find one or if you see one, it's worth a second look because again, it is very rare.
And you should, if you do see one, take some time out of whatever you're doing to scrutinize this beautiful vehicle because, A, you will probably never see it in person again, and, B, the cost for developing this car was so steep that Citroën had to declare bankruptcy eventually in the mid-30s, and Michelin, who was Citroën's largest creditor, continued to run the place as a research lab.
So they put a bunch of money into this, thinking that this is the future, and man, it just ran them out of business.
The oldest surviving Avant 7A is on display right now, I believe, at the Citroën Museum in Paris.
Hmm.
So you can check it out.
Interesting. So it's on permanent display. You can go check it out. And I know that there are a couple of other examples that, you know, this integrated design, like we mentioned, where you actually fill these hoppers with coal. That's kind of unusual. I mean, in that, you know, not all cars were like that. There were others that had very unwieldy designs. I mean, some that were just remarkably un-aerodynamic and to say the least. I mean, not that that was really the concern because they were just trying to get somewhere under power rather than having to walk or having to use, you know, the horse and buggy cart or whatever they had to
use.
Right.
Yeah. None of these were perfect solutions or perfect replacements for the conventional gasoline, but that didn't stop people from trying. I think we have another example.
No, and you know what? These go all through history. I mean, once we started kind of messing around with this type of stuff, you know, from early on, I mean, I think when we started talking about this, it was like 1916, 1910, whatever. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know when it was started even, but this goes much, much longer than you think, and it may even carry on until, you know, present day, but there's some surprises here that you know Rudy had mentioned in his email, and I think we've already kind of hinted at this, that there's a coal-powered Cadillac from the late 70s that I want to talk about. Yeah, it's really a cool thing. Now, a lot of people know about Chrysler's turbine power, or turbine cars, rather, turbine program is probably the better way to say it, and that's pretty well known, but not a whole lot of people know about General Motors' turbine program, other than, you know, maybe listening to Car Stuff where we talked about, you know, the Firebird vehicles, right?
Yes.
So they've been doing it since the 1950s, early 1950s, as a matter of fact. And, man, I mean, I guess they've been doing it for like, 40, 50 years now, 60 years at this point. They've been kind of carrying this on. But there was a powdered coal-fired turbine-powered Eldorado. I have to say that again. Powdered coal-fired, turbine-powered Eldorado that GM developed. And this is, again, related to a time of crisis. Remember, there was the fuel crisis in the early 1970s. Now, this is from 1978. So, you know, where does that kind of fit in, I guess? Well, it's because, and you know what? Give me just a minute. I'll get to it. Why they use the late 70s Cadillac for this particular model. But I guess going all the way back to the 1930s with the Allison division, that's when GM has been working on or had been working on their jet aircraft engines. And by the 1950s, you know, they had kind of figured things out that maybe we could kind of push this towards production. And that's when they kind of started toying around with the Firebird vehicles, the Firebird 1, 2, 3. Well, the Allison company, of course, you know, they've been around a long, long time, and I think they've just recently been sold, not recently, but since 1995, they've been sold to Rolls-Royce.
Ah,
so Allison is now part of Rolls-Royce, but at one time, they were part of General Motors, and that would be right during the time when we're talking about here. And that comes into play in just a moment. Now, turbines aren't known necessarily to be extremely fuel efficient. That's bad.
That is true.
Right?
They have some disadvantages.
Well,
for sure.
Yeah, they do have a lot of disadvantages, but some of the advantages are that they can run on just about anything that burns.
That is by far the primary advantage.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, they decided that coal dust might be one of the greatest things for them to use for this particular project. And, you know, before you say, you know, that's maybe not the best idea. Why don't you use, you know, kerosene? Or why
sure.
don't you use some other, you know, the product that you can just readily, you know,
readily find,
yeah,
create.
Yeah. It's a lot easier than coal dust, I'll tell you, because coal dust, as we'll find out, is a kind of a silly thing to try to use. But
it's a tricky medium.
Yeah,
for
it's,
sure.
it's something that it, even now it doesn't really play out all that well. But they point out in this article that Rudolf Diesel, when he first started experimenting with his diesel engine, was going to use coal dust as a fuel and later gave that up and decided that, you know, the fuel oil that they used
liquid.
Was, yeah, exactly. They determined that it just wasn't feasible for this coal dust. It was just too difficult a product for him to use in his early tests, so it just didn't work out. Now, we have a lot of fuel here in the United States, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not a lot of fuel, a lot of coal.
We have a lot of coal, exactly.
We have a lot of coal. So GM kind of got this interest in saying, you know, like, well, maybe we can't get the gasoline imported all that cheaply because, again, think about the time, the early 1970s.
Yeah.
There were lines, you know, blocks long for fuel and there was rationing going on.
So let's stop relying on the tricky business of foreign relations, which is ultimately what it is.
Exactly, yeah. So they were saying, like, why don't we try to become more energy efficient? Does this sound
a little familiar.
A little familiar, a little relevant maybe to right now.
So, some deja vu.
So, yeah, they're saying we're interested in getting these coal-burning engines up and going. What are we going to put this in? Well, as a test mule vehicle, they had very few options because the apparatus to make this whole thing work is pretty large. And you got to think about what had happened. Now, the fuel crisis had made a lot of these manufacturers downsize their vehicles in order to get better fuel economy and be much more efficient, right? So you didn't have these giant cars. Well, they did have one car left. They had the 1978 Cadillac Eldorado.
Uh-huh.
Now, at the time, they had already downsized the Cadillac. So they had the 79 models available, but they're smaller. So
right.
they went back to the 1978 model, which was still one of these giant, land yacht type vehicles. Huge.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was meant to have a 500 cubic inch big block engine under the hood. So it had a lot of space under there. Had an enormous trunk. I mean, just a gigantic trunk. So any kind of machinery or apparatus you needed.
Sure.
Lots of space. Other cars, not so much. You would have to have add-on units that just didn't look right, didn't fit with the vehicle, whatever.
So from an engineering perspective, it was possible to put this newly applied technology into the Eldorado and still preserve the form factor.
Yeah, applied is the key word because this technology is not new.
Very old.
Yeah, very old as a matter of fact. But the method that they used to get it into the engine or to create this was something new. Now, I want to read one little bit here. This is just a very short paragraph, I promise, but it kind of tells you where they're coming from. And it's in this article. It says, according to retired GM engineer John Schult, who described the system to the New York Times in 2009, he said to keep the coal dust ready for delivery to the engine, it had to be continually agitated. Then a small conveyor belt delivered the coal to the gasifier, the first section of GM's automotive turbine engine. So when you stepped on the gas pedal, it actually moved the potentiometer that varied the speed of the coal conveyor belt. So more fuel resulted in more power.
A
conveyor belt, this agitator, there's this coal dust that you've got to somehow wrangle.
That's a lot of stuff that
and
can break.
And I guess the coal dust was so fine that they used that if you were to take the coal dust in your fingers and rub it between your fingers, it became oily and greasy. That's almost like a silt, if you've ever felt silt. It's a very silky feeling. There were a lot of downsides to this. Now, there's a lot of lag due to the fuel delivery system. There's lots of noise that was created by the turbine, the coal dust agitator, and then, of course, there's this air compressor, which blows the whole mix into the engine. And then, of course, refueling, it was an extremely messy procedure, like I mentioned, with the dust, and there's this greasy coal dust that gets everywhere.
Disaster.
So, all right, so they tried this for a few years. You know, there were, again, a lot of downsides, and then, of course, you know, we kind of figured everything out. You know, the crisis sort of ended, in a way. It lessened, I should say.
Sure.
And, vehicles became more efficient. They downsized everything, and we kind of got into this groove again, you know, where things were working okay. So they kind of abandoned this project. Well, they shipped the car back to Allison, where the project was, you know, kind of moved over to.
Yeah.
Never heard from again.
What?
Yeah, the car disappeared. So it's another one of those mystery cars. Now, You know, in the past, we've said that about a few cars, and listeners have said, you know what, here's an article from Hemmings where they found it.
Yes.
I hope that happens, but
you
know, this coal dust-powered Cadillac that was shipped to Allison, again, probably the early 1980s, it has disappeared, Ben. It's gone.
Unless a listener writes in, now, Scott, you and I are referring specifically to an excellent email we got that we're going to read on air at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spoil the surprise, but we do owe a listener a big thank you. Before we go on to wood-burning cars.
Yeah, because there's some good stuff on wood-burning cars that we're going to come up to.
Yes. I was thinking, if it's okay, I could tell you about a documentary that I watched recently.
Sure.
Okay. It's about alternative fuel, or maybe the original fuel.
That fits right in perfectly.
Yeah, I'm talking about human-powered vehicles, Scott.
Oh, really?
Yes, I'm talking about Hell on Wheels, my friend, a documentary about the Tour de France,
okay.
Which covers the athletes going through this brutal race,
mm-hmm.
as well as their supporters. I was checking this out on Netflix Instant, which, as you know, you and I get to watch all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people who are race fans are play favorites, right? Everybody
sure.
does.
Of course.
You might be an F1 guy, you might be a NASCAR girl, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that surprised me, I was a little skeptical because I thought, oh, yeah, it's very human. It's very noble.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. You're on a bike. Your top speed is not going to hold my attention,
yeah.
which makes me sound like a jerk. But to be honest, man, watching this, you really get a sense of what amazing work has to go into these things and how just how demanding this actually is. So I'm going to go ahead and throw my, I guess, audio hat in the ring here and say that if you do like racing, you will probably enjoy Hell on Wheels.
Yeah, there's a surprising amount of technology that goes into the bikes.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, the rider training and strength development and all that and what they go through during the, I don't know how many days this thing lasts. Mm. It's a long time.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very difficult race. It's one of these, kind of like a great test, like a great endurance test for man and I guess machine, I guess, the bike, right?
Sure. The bike is a machine. The bike is, you know, like any other race, the bike sort of becomes, just like a car would, the bike sort of becomes an extension of the rider or the driver in the best conditions.
It can be very exciting to watch.
And you can watch it for free on Netflix Instant. All you have to do, it doesn't matter if you don't have a Netflix subscription, all you have to do is go to netflix.com/carstuff, sign up for a free 30-day trial where you don't have to watch Hell on Wheels if mm-hmm. you don't want to.
No. And you know what? Titles are subject to availability, mm-hmm. but you know that one's there. And Ben suggested it. What more do you need, really?
And if that suggestion's not good enough, there are thousands of other titles that you can check out. We also, every so often, you and I like to recommend some, so check through our past podcast and you'll see some equally amazing recommendations. I think that we could go right to wood-burning cars.
I think that's a good idea. Now, we talked about coal gasification and the Fischer-Tropsch process.
I think you're doing a good job.
I think that's it. Now, let's talk about there's something called a wood gas generator. And now, wood gas generator is a gasification unit which converts timber or charcoal into wood gas or syngas, synthetic gas,
mm-hmm.
Which has atmospheric nitrogen, carbon monoxide, hydrogen, and just a little bit of methane and some other gases. And after you cool it and filter it, that gas can then be used to power an internal combustion engine for, you know, whatever purpose you need. So you're able to power that. But the problem is, how do you get fuel out of, you know, I mean, we just mentioned it with this
right.
unit, but how do you get, you know, how do you look at something like a tree or, you know, just a
yeah.
lump of wood, a pile of wood and say, I'm going to have to use that to power my car? That takes some ingenuity. And when you look at a wood gas generator, one of these gasification units, because there are modern versions of it. Now, there are old versions of this, too. I mean, they go back to the same time that we talked about, you know, World War II and, you know, all the reasons, you know, with the crises mm-hmm. and the rationing and everything. But when you look at even a modern version of this, these are enormous units that have to be somehow integrated into the automobile.
Or and often just tacked to the back.
Yeah, that's more or less what happens, really. Now, when you look at any kind of, I open this up to the listeners to just do a search for wood gas vehicles. Mm-hmm. And you're going to find that, honestly, Ben, looking back to World War II and modern versions of this,
yeah,
the design hasn't changed all that much. The cars are different.
Yeah, but the more things change, the more
literally, when I tell you this, like, modern versions, occasionally, some of these gasification units, these power plants that you have to tow along behind with these things on these trailers, mm-hmm. equal in size to the car.
Yes. And here's one of the things that really caught me about the ingenuity here. So, the question, right, you phrased it in such a swell way, how do you look at a pile of wood or a tree and say, yeah, I could make a car go off that?
How do you do it? Would think steam power. You would initially think, like, I'm just going to burn that to create heat to create something, to do something else.
That's where we both went.
It's not that I'm going to use that biomass to make a fuel to power the engine that's already in there.
So here's one of the descriptions I heard of how this works. Mm-hmm. So the wood will be heated until it starts to chemically break down. So when wood burns in, like regular fire when you're out camping with your buddies, mm-hmm. it decomposes due to the heat and some of the gases that the wood produces are flammable. And so they burn when they're released and boom, that's the flame we see, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So in these wood burning cars, at least around World War II, the wood's heated to a temperature that's hot enough to decompose the wood, but they don't allow the gas to burn. And so instead it's stored in a chamber, mm-hmm. which is that big cylindrical looking thing tacked on there.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, the gas that's stored in that chamber is injected in the cylinders of, your regular IC engine.
Makes perfect sense, I guess. I mean, it's a very complex way to get to where you need to be, I guess.
Yeah.
But honestly, seriously, look back at the World War II photos and then look at modern versions of wood gas powered cars and you're going to see very striking similarities between the two. I mean, in many cases, a lot of times they use a trailer to bring these things along or they build a platform on the back of the car.
Yeah.
It's never out at the front of the car because there's just too much machinery to look over, as a matter of fact.
It's always
going to be a platform in the back or, it may be in the bed of the truck that it's powering or it may be in the bed of a, I think I saw an El Camino type vehicle, a sport ute, some type of vehicle. Sport ute, a utility vehicle.
Yeah.
It's almost comical to see it, but then you realize, Ben, I was reading about these pretty carefully here, reading this article. There's a modern version of this, a Volvo that somebody has converted to demonstrate the possibility of the technology. It's not so much that this is their only vehicle or
it's like
a
proof of concept.
Yeah, I guess so. Just to kind of show that I can do this.
Okay.
This particular Volvo that I'm going to mention, it has a top speed, a maximum speed of 75 miles per hour. Cruising speed would be about 68. The fuel tank can hold about 66 pounds of wood, which is good for a range of, get this, 62 miles.
Not bad at all.
That's not bad. Now, range, this is important, and I think we need to dive into this maybe.
Yeah, let's dive into this.
Okay, 62 miles, so that's, you're carrying 66 pounds of wood, you get 62 miles out of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not that far off from current modern electric car ranges, is it?
It is not, and that is a point that we talked about before. There are a couple of points we made here. It is surprisingly close because, again, I think, I don't know about you, but I really did have this assumption in my head that lower MPH equals higher MPG.
Mm-hmm,
and that's
sure.
not always the case, especially not when we're talking about these different biomass fuels.
Yeah.
And so I think... We were both kind of surprised to find that range was so similar to an electric car.
I was surprised they got so much. Now, if you go back to World War II days, the range of these cars may be 30 miles.
Sure, much
maybe
lower.
Maybe half that. Now, a lot of efficiencies have been made in this, but I guess, when you look at the units that's, especially this Volvo that I'm looking at, it's got, mm-hmm. it almost looks like a brewery, a small brewery that's attached to the back. The big tanks, I don't even know what you call them, but the fermentation tanks.
Mm-hmm.
It's something like that. I mean, it's very big, very, very,
unwieldy is a good word.
Yeah, maybe. That's probably the best way to say it. But, You know, it's funny. I struggle with this in that, you know, they compare them to modern electric cars as far as range go. Now, you do have to refuel by throwing in more wood. So
yes.
You have to carry some wood. Let's say it's in your trunk, in your back seat, whatever. And that's just, I think this is just if he fills the hopper with 66 pounds of wood, because it doesn't take a whole lot of wood to make 66 pounds if you've ever lifted,
wood,
you know,
yeah.
wood, you know, out in the backyard or whatever, splitting wood,
right.
whatever. But I want to mention here that it says if you do load the back seat of this car with wood, so you're carrying a lot more wood, you know, than you would, you can extend that range to about 250 miles. Now, before someone says that it's a little crazy, well, you got to remember that a lot of times in a modern electric car, you'll sacrifice the back seat space anyways
for
a larger battery. Right. And the examples that he gives are the Tesla Roadster and the electric Mini Cooper, where you know, both of those vehicles only have two seats anyways. And that's because there's such a, well, of course, the Tesla Roadster is based on the Lotus design.
Yeah.
But the Mini Cooper, you're actually sacrificing the back seat space for a larger battery in order to get the extended distance. And that's very comparable again to what you would get in a modern electric car. Now, I mean, this goes up even higher. I mean, the more wood you carry. So let's say that, you know, you've got in this example, there's a guy that can carry 400 pounds of wood in the back of a 1989 Ford pickup truck.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So this is an old pickup truck, a 1989. Uh-huh. The range on that vehicle, Ben, now he has to add fuel occasionally, add wood to the mix there, but, the range of the car before he runs out of his 400 pounds of wood is 600 miles. So that's not bad. That's, again, that's about the distance you would get in a very efficient modern car.
Yeah, and you could just keep going too. All you need is an axe. Mm-hmm. You don't need a gas station.
Yeah,
you just need an axe.
Yeah, I think I saw something about a guy that did a cross-country tour with just an axe in his car. Mm-hmm. And he would, you know, pull off to the side of the road and ask local farmers if he could cut down, you know, some dead wood on their property and use that as fuel, just to kind of prove that he could make it across, you know, with nothing more than, again, an axe.
I like that we're going modern. Let's, you know what, let's say we end out here on some modern things, right?
Sure.
Okay. So we've got one thing that I thought would surprise you, but it turned out you already know. Before we get to it, I want to say something that I hope is not controversial, because it is true. It's interesting, your point about electric car performance and these biomass-burning car performances, or let's call it synthetic fuel or whatever, because let's face it, an electric or a hybrid car derives its power partially or completely from electricity. And this electricity is transported, stored, distributed via the normal power grid system of, you know, your local city or your local town, right?
Sure.
And in the United States, that power is overwhelmingly likely to ultimately come from coal.
Yeah, but not 100%.
Not 100%. Okay, yeah. All right, I see. Are you about to say what I think you're about to say?
I think I have to, because I know that someone will write in and say, wait a minute, I've got an electric-powered car, and, you know, it's powered by clean energy. It's radioactive material that creates my electricity.
The Hoover Dam powers
exactly. So there's hydroelectric power. You said it. You said it correctly.
It's wind power.
Overwhelmingly, most of the plants here in the United States still are coal-operated plants. So when you hear that, you'll hear this a lot, and I'm not going to argue for or against this. It's just that a lot of people say, yeah, that electric car is still coal-powered, and that, you know, coal is powering the power plant that creates electricity for your electric car.
And I think it's an interesting point to think about when you say this stuff. Now, again, of course, the energy mix that the United States as a whole is using for domestic power is changing. We're seeing the emergence of wind, solar. I mean, the Hoover Dam alone is just this amazing thing. So it's quite possible then that if you own an electric car, depending on where you're deriving this electricity from, you could be driving what's ultimately a water-powered car.
Yeah,
you know?
I guess it's all in how you look at it.
It's all in how you look at it. But that's not the only modern example we have. There was recently in the news a resurgence of a coal-powered car, right?
That's right. Yeah, there's a very modern version of this. Now, we're talking right up until just a couple months ago.
Yeah, March 2013.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, there's someone from the Ohio State University. I think it was a chemical engineer and director of OSU's Clean Coal Research Laboratory who has developed this way to Power a car with coal again, Ben. I mean, these coal pellets are, I'm sorry, it's just coal and iron oxide pellets.
Right. And this is, the chemical engineer, I'm going to butcher his name, Long Shifang. And, he said that this method uses these iron oxide pellets as an oxygen source. So it can contain this reaction in a small chamber.
Mm-hmm. Now we mentioned, these clean coal pellets, which are used to really, I mean, what this does is it creates or generates electricity for an electric car. Now, it does it all on board. That's the difference. It's completely generated on board. It's not, there's no need to plug it in. You know, there's no, you know, external grid work that's necessary.
I mean,
you would be able to go somewhere. This is the plan, to be able to you know, pull up to a filling station, I guess you'd call it, I suppose. I don't know what they would call it if you're doing this, but a filling station, we'll call it, where these clean coal pellets would be introduced into the on-car storage tank, mm-hmm. and then the clean coal would then be used to generate electricity through an onboard generator, which would charge up something they call an ultracapacitor.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultracapacitors would be used for, or the capacitors would be used for, like, bursts of acceleration or speed, like hill climbing. Now, most of the time, this would be generating electricity that would just power a generator that would
assist the engine.
Exactly. That would be the engine, really. I mean, it would be the motor.
Oh, yeah.
So it's an all-electric car.
That's right. Yeah.
And the one greatest benefit of this whole thing, you want to tell us what that would be?
I want you to do it.
All right. Well, I mean, the greatest thing about this, I guess, is that there's really no waste products. I mean, none that enter the atmosphere.
Yeah, there's water and solid coal ash mm-hmm. are the primary waste products. So listen carefully, folks. No greenhouse gases if this thing works.
Yeah, because when you burn coal, you get carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. And the thing about this is that the byproduct is water and the solid coal ash, which can then be disposed of, you know, properly. It's not, you know, expelled out into the atmosphere. This is something that's contained and able to be handled in a safe and efficient manner. And I think that even the iron oxide pellets can be reused, is right?
They can
be recycled. So the whole process, I mean, the entire thing is supposed to rival battery-powered hybrids. And it's supposed to be kind of coming to a car near you soon, but the idea is that they have to miniaturize the entire operation. Now that's the problem.
That's what I was going to say too, man. I don't think this is ready to compete with hybrid or electric.
Yeah,
cars.
And when I say, you know, coming to a car near you soon, I mean, you know how that works, Ben.
It's always 5 years, right?
It seems like 5 or 10. Yeah,
they're
like,
years.
Well, in about 10 years, we're going to have this ready. And you know, there's no mention here in this article, you know, about the timeline of this whole thing, but
right.
Man, I mean, again, it's coming down to ingenuity, isn't it? I mean, it's somebody who's still working on clean coal and trying to make that work. And I don't know, it seems like a good alternative. I mean, if they're going to go the way of, you know, electric cars and, you know, plug-in
sure.
hybrids and
yeah.
all this, why not have something that can generate its own electricity on board cleanly mm-hmm. rather than having to plug into a grid, which is then powered by coal somewhere else? Because that, you know, those electric cars aren't as clean as people think a lot of times.
Often. And again, I think you made a very fair point. It depends on the source of that electricity.
Yeah,
and I won't let any mention of the Tesla Roadster pass on air without saying that I am in love with that car.
You're talking about the Model S.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the Tesla S model. That gets high marks. And by the way, that's a standout. I've got a chart here that I didn't get to when you're talking about ranges of the wood gas cars.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a whole chart here with ranges of current model electric cars. And the Model S is just far and above everybody else on this thing as far as all electric goes. It's got something like 265, where the others, the ranges are anywhere between, you know, like 13 to, you know, 60 is, mm-hmm. is normal. So the Model S is really a standout.
It's an exception.
It is. And again, you know, this coal-powered electricity generation thing, it's so dependent on your geography, exactly where you are. So, you know, we understand that completely. Some people have got really, really clean power. Others have, you know, water power, hydropower, and others are still using this coal-generated electricity.
Okay.
And that's for the most part, most of us here in the United States.
Right, right, statistically. Now, there's one last fact before we get out of here that I thought you would enjoy, Scott.
What's that?
You know, we talked about gas bag buses, right? Gas bag vehicles.
Yeah.
Well, gas bag buses were still being used in China as recently as the 1990s.
Oh, come on.
As recently as the 1990s, my friend.
Really?
In Chongqing, I'm probably mispronouncing that, they were developed during peacetime as part of public transit. So they were also in Shandong in 1965, but yes,
you know,
the
Ben,
last word.
I would hope these had some type of cage built around them that was impervious. I mean, that, you know, it just seems like a down power line, you know, that or that they brush against or something,
right,
could cause a Hindenburg-esque accident to happen right there in the streets, you know? I mean, it just seems like there's a lot of potential danger with these things.
Yeah, it reminded me of airships too, Scott, because it's a huge design flaw that the bulk of a vehicle would be an exposed, flammable bag.
Yeah, sure. Big Zeppelin on top of your car.
Yeah, but again, that goes back to necessity. You invent what you can.
True.
And refine the rest. And we are going to head out. We hope that everybody enjoyed this episode. I'd like to thank Rudy for the excellent recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we'd love to hear your stories about alternative fuels. Maybe somebody owns a wood-burning car, Scott. What do you think?
Maybe. I mean, it seems, I don't know. Maybe.
They made it if they own it.
Yeah.
So let us know. You can find us on Facebook. We are also on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you at our email address, which is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.